So tonight, we're going to be talking about the existence of God and some of the arguments for the existence for God. And I came upon this. I am an atheist. I'm not an atheist because it's cool. I'm not an atheist because of religious extremism or oppression in some depraved corners of the world. I'm not an atheist because I don't think evil can exist in a world with a God. I'm not an atheist because I think science can disprove God. I'm not an atheist because I think science can disprove God. I'm an atheist because of one simple fact. The burden of proof lies on religion. If you propose the existence of something, you must follow the scientific method in your defense of its existence. Otherwise, I have no reason to listen to you. This person has a fundamental misunderstanding of science. So the scientific method is a very structured thing. It involves the creation of something called a hypothesis. A hypothesis is an idea about how something works, and it has to be testable. You have to be able to, what we call in science, we have to be able to falsify it, basically. That hypothesis, if you can control all the variables that go into testing that hypothesis, and you can do it over and over and over again, eventually that hypothesis might graduate and become a theory. And if that theory stands the test of time and continues to be tested over and over again, that becomes a law. There are certain things that the scientific method just wasn't made to do. This man, whoever said this, man or woman, couldn't even prove their own existence using the scientific method. Because the scientific method wasn't made to prove existence. There's other arguments that have to come into play. And so this is kind of what we're dealing with. We have to be able to define the terms, we have to be able to address the people, and say, you know what, the science has its limits, it has its boundaries. And for other things, like a court case, you don't establish court cases through science, you establish them through history and eyewitnesses and those kinds of things. You can go on and on and on and talk about the boundaries of what witnesses can do, what science can do, and everything else. And tonight, we're going to present some arguments for the existence of God. We know there's some weaknesses to them. We know there's some boundaries as to what they can describe and what they can do. But we're going to dive in. We're going to start with, this isn't really the moral argument. This is kind of like a permutation of the moral argument. The moral argument is, I think, a good argument, but it has some flaws. What we're going to do, though, is a little bit different spin on it. We're going to talk about preparing an atheist or someone who doesn't believe in the existence of God's heart so that they understand the ramifications if they say God does not exist. So we're going to push the question, what if God did not exist? And we're not going to try in this particular portion. We'll go ahead on to the arguments a little later. We'll not prove God's existence through this exercise, but I think it will help us surface the importance of the question. If God does not exist, then the following three things have no foundation. The first one of them is meaning. Meaning has no foundation. Meaning has to do with significance, why something matters in the grand scheme of things. The second thing that we wouldn't have a foundation for if God does not exist are values. And when I use the term value tonight, I'm going to be using it in reference to doing with good and evil, right and wrong. And the third thing is purpose. Purpose has to do with a goal, a reason for something, a direction, a destination to which it's going. So, reading here from William Lane Craig, a philosopher, from his book On Guard, Defending Your Faith with Reason and Precision, which is a great book, by the way. I'd recommend it to anybody. It says, my claim is that if there is no God, then meaning, value, and purpose are ultimately human illusions. They're just in our heads. If atheism is true, then life is really objectively meaningless, valueless, and purposeless, despite our subjective beliefs to the contrary. And so basically he's saying if God doesn't exist, then all of these things are just an illusion in the minds of atheists. They're playing a game. They're playing a game on their own terms. Man, like all biological organisms, must die. With no hope of immortality, man's life leads only to the grave. His life is but a spark in the infinite blackness, a spark that appears, flickers, and dies forever. The universe, too, faces a death of its own. Scientists tell us that the universe is expanding and galaxies are growing farther and farther apart. As it does so, it grows colder and colder as its energy is used up, and eventually all the stars will burn out, all matter will collapse into dead stars and black holes, and there will be no light, there will be no heat, there will be no life. Only the corpses of dead stars and galaxies ever expanding into endless darkness and the cold recesses of space, a universe in ruins. How does that make you feel? How do you think that atheists deal with this? How do you think they deal with this reality? I'll open it up and get some conversation flowing before we get into the next couple slides. How do they deal with this?
Ignore it.
Yeah, it's actually somewhat difficult to find quotes on death by atheists. You'll find some references to the celestial dirt map that they like to refer to it as, but they avoid it like the plague. Because the other thing you'll find inspirational quotes is, I'm going to live this life as if it was the only life that I had to live, because it is. You know, this kind of strange thing. Oh, have you met somebody that was a thoroughgoing atheist? Anybody? Can you tell us a little bit about their perspective, what they had to say, why they were atheists?
Can I?
I can talk to you, yeah.
Okay. Well, I have an uncle who's a thoroughgoing atheist. He's a Christian and then, you know, got married to a Catholic and that whole story. And now is an about atheist, but it's always shocked me how little he knows about it. Like, his atheism, I don't know if he would admit it, is just a hatred for God. Mm-hmm. And he wants to play by his own rules, basically.
Yeah.
So he really doesn't have answers for any questions I've ever asked him, even basic stuff. Like, when I first got into it, I started studying evolution so that I could talk to him. And then I started talking to him and found out I knew a lot more about it than he did. So he didn't care about it. He just wanted an excuse not to believe in God.
So he's kind of apathetic towards the whole thing, and it was just convenient and somewhat intellectually satisfying to put himself into that little bucket. Yeah, Andrew.
Well, an acquaintance that we had known for a while, and I don't know if she ever really was a believer. I don't think she was a believer, but I think she was more, she wasn't a non-believer. She wasn't an atheist when we used to know her. And recently she has become an atheist, and she's put a lot of stuff out on the social media sites and stuff like that. And I think she also at the same time has decided to become homosexual. And so I think that at the same time, she's just kind of denounced God and denounced anything. Like, it's almost like an anger thing, the fact that she doesn't want to be told that she's a sinner. So then she just decides there's no God. And then that makes it easier to understand that she's not doing anything wrong. So Nathan deleted her. I kind of was like nosy and like to follow it, but he didn't want us. But I was. But I think that had a lot to do with it, too. I think she just... You don't
want
to be confronted with your sin. So.
Right, and that's exactly what Aldous Huxley said. Aldous Huxley was Darwin's bulldog, one of his biggest defenders, and really fought for evolutionary Darwinism. And Aldous Huxley said basically that he there's some plausibility that God might exist, but at the end of the day, that got in the way of his adultery. And so he really didn't want to play that game. So it's kind of profound. How an atheist keeps everything together, because these are the necessary ramifications. You have no value, no right and wrong, no meaning, and no purpose. And let's look at that first one on here. God, without God, there's no meaning to life. And William Blaine Craig says, mankind is thus no more significant than a swarm of mosquitoes or a barnyard of pigs, for their end is all the same. The same blind cosmic process that coughed them up in the first place will eventually swallow them all again. The contributions of the scientists to the advance of human knowledge, the researches of the doctor to alleviate pain and suffering, the efforts of the diplomat to secure peace in the world, the sacrifices of good people everywhere to better the lot of the human race, all these come to nothing. And this is the horror of modern man. Because he ends in nothing, he is nothing. Kind of quite a quote. And you see this, kind of pop up in popular philosophies. So the founder for the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals has this kind of moral compass. She says, a rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy. Moral equivalence of all those things. If you they're all equal in the grand scheme of things. She just happens to have a high view of life, but within the evolutionary framework in all life. So the rat is the same as the child, right? But on the evolutionary framework, what rationale does she have for making that choice? Not really any. Not really any. So without God, there is no meaning to life. There's a story in sci-fi about an astronaut who was sent out on an extraordinarily long voyage. And the only thing that really was going to get him there and back was this master of engineering, his spaceship. And it had all the latest drives and life support systems and everything else. But when he gets to this barren hunk of rock that has not a single iota of life on it, his ship dies and he's stranded. And he's been given two vials, one vial that contains poison and one that will give him unending life. And as the story goes, he decides to take his own life because life is really meaningless. He's out here alone. There's no one with him. And he drinks his vial, and to his horror, he discovers he drank the wrong one. And he is now forever alone on this barren chunk of rock with no relationships, no meaning, no destination, no purpose, and total isolation. It's kind of a horrible story. But the question becomes, is it a meaningless life, or do you choose death? Without God, there's no ultimate value. There's no right or wrong. Fyodor Dostoevsky said, if there is no immortality, then all things are permitted. And it proves very much true. If there's no God, there's no ultimate value, no right or wrong. Do you notice somebody in here that's a little unusual in this picture? Brian Williams. There's also pictures of him on the internet now reporting the moon landing live from the moon. All kinds of things. But, I mean, why do we say that this guy was wrong to lie to us about an event that occurred, 14 years ago? If you don't know the story, basically Brian Williams claimed that he was in a helicopter with the military. The helicopter was fired upon in Iraq by a rocket-propelled grenade. It crashed, and he survived, and they were rescued by, a battalion or something after a firefight, and he's lived to survive the day. That was his story. And we later hear from the guys that actually took him in. They said he never was on that helicopter. They said a helicopter went down. He was nowhere near it. So he totally fabricated his story. And now they're finding Ryan Williams has other stories and everything else. But why if there is no God, there is no real right or wrong. You have to have something outside of yourself that determines absolute right and wrong, right? If you don't have that, then if we determine what right and wrong is on an individual level and there is no rhyme or reason to it, then it's just a matter of our tastes and preferences at the end of the day. What does Owen feel like today? I feel like running down people in my car. Well, that's morally right, for today. And we have no real reason to claim that Brian Williams is a liar or is morally wrong. Or we might say he's a liar, but why should there be any ramifications for it? Why is he going to be off for 6 months and probably for the rest of his life if he's not careful? There is no right. There is no wrong. There is merely cause and effect. That's what it boils down to. Without God, there's no real value, no right or wrong. Richard Wurmbrand, who wrote the book Tortured for Christ, said, "The cruelty of atheism is hard to believe when man has no faith in the reward of good or the punishment of evil. There is no reason to be human. There is no restraint from the depths of evil which is in man. The communist torturers, who he was tortured by the communists, often said, there is no God, no hereafter, no punishment for evil. We can do what we wish." And I have heard one torturer even say, "I thank God, in whom I don't believe, that I have lived to this hour when I can express all the evil in my heart." And he expressed it in unbelievable brutality and torture inflicted on prisoners. I think this is a picture shortly after Richard Wurmbrand got out of prison. But within atheism, within the idea there's no God, there's no standards for how you conduct yourself. You can do as you please. It's merely a matter of culture. As we've already mentioned, in atheism, it's merely a matter of taste. How do you feel today? What do you want to do? And we need to take people to this level. Here's a comic. You have a cow who is grilling meat. He's doing a barbecue. And the other cows come up and say, "You're sick, Jerry. Sick, sick, sick." Historian Stuart C. Easton sums it up well when he writes, "There is no objective reason why man should be moral unless morality pays off in his social life or makes him feel good. There is no objective reason why man should do anything save for the pleasure it affords him." Isn't that true? If there's no standard for right and wrong, if there's no one that's going to render ultimate judgment and justice for the things that we do in this life, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. And this life truly is it. And so who can make... What we're finding on campus when we talk to the young people that are down at Ohio State, of all things, and you ask them certain questions, you begin to get into this whole thing about Jesus and everything else, and you talk about evil, they really don't have a connection with that anymore. It's strange. You can actually see a growing darkness there. But they will not... Many of the students to this day, I thought it was anecdotal, I thought it was just somebody making up stories, but they will not condemn Hitler. They have no compass point for condemning Hitler anymore, because he just did what was right for his time, it was culturally appropriate. Right and wrong is totally tied to what a culture feels, what a culture wants to be, and so there was no need any further to condemn Hitler. No need any further to condemn Stalin or Pol Pot or any of the other mass murders of our last century or so. And so, without God, there's no ultimate value. And those preferences and tastes that we have, if we lived like there was no God, those come into conflict, right? Little old ladies in front of you on the road, what do? Do you just kind of pass around her, or do you ram her into the guardrail and, you know, keep on going? These things do have consequences. Morality, as I've already said, simply becomes a matter of taste and preference. And so these are the kind of questions that in our culture, if you ask them on campus, you're increasingly getting a shocking answer. Was widow burning in India morally wrong? They had a custom when a man died, they would also burn his wife in the funeral pyre with him, even though she was still alive. They'd throw her alive into the flames. This was a common custom in India, which has been somewhat ended in India by their law. They put an end to it, but you still every once in a while hear a story about this happening to this day because it's a deeply seated tradition of that culture. Is it wrong? In some cultures, they love their neighbors, and in others, they eat them. Which do you prefer? Yeah, I actually, believe it or not, I was sitting with some Mormon missionaries, Latter-day Saints in McDonald's, and I posed this exact question, because we're talking about morality, and we're talking about they have an eternal regression of gods. They call it eternal progression, but you become a god eventually in that religion. And I was talking about how did they get morality for each one of those individuals that becomes a god? Who determines it? And he said, well, it's culturally determined by that particular god. And I said, okay. I said, what about this? I said, which one's right and which one's wrong? And they said, whatever is culturally dominant. That is right. That's wrong. And it even went to, I said, even eating them? And they said, yes. I was like, these are the nice, bright, you know, cleanly dressed guys, you know, just slick as anything else. And they're telling me these kind of answers. I was shocked. Does a land exist where murder is a virtue and thanksgiving a vice? Were the Nazis justified in their actions given the culture and power in Germany that affirmed their actions? And is it okay for a culture to gratuitously torture innocent baby? In the end, if there's no God, there are no wrong answers. And it would be silly to assert one thing was wrong and another wasn't. To what authority do you go back to assert that anything is right or wrong? In the end, it's just you. You versus the world. Right? Whatever the world's majority opinion is at that time. So without God, there's no ultimate purpose. We'll breeze through this one. Ecclesiastes 3:19-20 kind of reads like some of the most modern of books because the writer of Ecclesiastes, the teacher, lived a life of indulgence. He was exploring things in many different ways. He says, "For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beast is the same. As one dies, so dies the other." In other words, they have the same destination. They have the same purpose. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beast. For all is vanity, all go to one place, all are from the dust, and to dust all return. And without God, there is no destination. It's just death. That's the main point of the writer here at this juncture. Without God, the universe is the result of a cosmic accident, a chance explosion. There is no reason for which it exists. And as for man, he's a freak of nature, a blind product of matter plus time plus chance. If God does not exist, then you are just a miscarriage of nature, thrust into a purposeless universe to live a purposeless life. Pretty crazy. And yet you can have atheists like Richard Dawkins or the late Carl Sagan or the late Christopher Hitchens that'll talk about the wonders of the universe. Really? It's just an accident. How can it stir wonder? How can it stir any emotion? And then, as we'll see in a few moments, why be appalled at murder? Why be appalled at killing? It's just the cycle. Why is it in us to abominate those kinds of things? Without God, the fundamental problem, and the fundamental problem with this solution is that it's impossible to live consistently and happily within the framework of such a worldview. If you live consistently, you will not be happy. If you live happily, it's only because you are not consistent. And we have to answer these questions. By what standard do we determine what is right and wrong? Where am I going? Why is life better than death at the end of the day? Why is that? Because we all end up in the same destination. Some of us are just going to get there a little faster. Should I save the drowning cat or the drowning kid? I've actually thrown those out there as well. Ray Comfort, in one of his videos, because of the milieu that we're in right now, as he was doing his street preaching, they asked kids, your favorite pet is drowning in the lake. On the other side of the path, on the other side where there's also a lake, there's a drowning kid. Which one do you save? And there were an awful lot of people saying, I'd save my favorite pet. Why? Moral equivalence, evolution, atheism. There is no God. You just do what feels right. Right? At the end of the day. So, without God, I think the atheist problem is being consistent. And a lot of people are beating up on Richard Dawkins because he is demonstrating in a major way. But I'll say this, Richard Dawkins, a noted atheist, a brilliant guy, he's no different than other philosophers of the same cloth. Albert Camus had the same problem. Friedrich Nietzsche, who was a nihilist, had the same problem. And that's, you know, if there is no God, you have to come to certain realizations, which he's going to demonstrate in his first quote. But the problem is those realizations are unlivable. You can't live a life that way. So he says this. And his first quote, Richard Dawkins, the total amount of suffering per year in the natural world is beyond all decent contemplation. During the minute that it takes me to compose this sentence, thousands of animals are being eaten alive. Many others are running for their lives, whimpering with fear. Others are slowly being devoured from within by rasping parasites. Thousands of all kinds are dying of starvation, thirst, and disease. Doesn't he paint a beautiful picture? It must be so. If there ever is a time of plenty, this very fact will automatically lead to an increase in the population until the natural state of starvation and misery is restored. In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. And this is the kicker. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. And he's famous. This is one of his famous lines. Universe has nothing but pitiless indifference. But I just sampled from him, just one, and there's a lot of them out there. He says this, he was contemplating the rise of Islam as a force and the beheadings and everything else, and he says, I'm reasonably optimistic in America and Europe. I'm pessimistic about the Islamic world. I regard Islam as one of the greatest evils in the world, and I fear that we have a very difficult struggle there. What's evil? Why are they wrong? The universe is one of pitiless indifference. There's no design, no purpose, no evil, no good. Why do you care, Richard Dawkins? Because his philosophy of life, his belief, is unlivable. You can't live in it. You have to bust outside of it every single time. Human beings were made to create an island of morality. Make distinctions between right and wrong. It's unlivable to try to live in a world that doesn't have a right and a wrong. It's unlivable to live in a world that doesn't have a destination, a purpose, or where you can't say that there's significance to what we're doing. Totally unlivable. And this is the problem. What is evil without God? Is Richard Dawkins being consistent? So that's something I think we need to challenge our atheist friends with. And you could turn it into the moral argument, which I'm not going to cover tonight, and I probably won't cover it at all. But the moral argument is basically, in order to have a universal morality, be able to define something as right and wrong, you have to have an ultimately objective being outside of yourself. Not merely your subjective opinions about something, but somebody else that's all powerful that says this is right and this is wrong. If you don't have that, you can't have morality. And to be honest, you don't have an explanation either why there's consciences in human beings, why we all have the same imprint of God on each and every single one of us, God speaking to us through the conscience that he put in us. You don't have any explanation for that either. So tonight, for the arguments of God's existence, I've gone maybe a little bit different route. We'll start with Leibniz's premise. Leibniz was the discoverer of differential and integral calculus at the same time as Isaac Newton. Matter of fact, they came up with it so much, and Isaac Newton, kind of his work surged out to the front, that a lot of people thought Leibniz had defrauded him, had stolen his work, and that wasn't the case at all. They arrived at the same conclusions using different methodologies. This guy was brilliant. You know, Leibniz is unbelievable. And he says the first question should be, why is there something rather than nothing? Why does anything exist at all rather than nothing exist? That's kind of an oxymoron there. Leibniz had three premises, if you want to write them down. Everything that exists has an explanation of its existence. If the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God. And then the final conclusion, the final premise, the universe exists. And so these two conclusions would logically follow. The universe has an explanation of its existence from 2 and 3, and therefore the explanation, which I spelled wrong, of the universe's existence is God. You follow the argument? It's really tight. If the premises are true, if those first three things are true, then the conclusions logically follow whether or not somebody likes them or not. To refute the conclusions, 4 and 5 there, you have to kill one of 1, 2, or 3. You have to kill them. Okay? Any questions or comments about this? We're going to build on this. We're going to talk about some of the objections and some of the other things as we go into it. So, premise one is everything that exists has an explanation of its existence. The objection one is God must have an explanation of his existence. Something has to exist without an explanation. And so we would answer that by saying Leibniz believes that there are two kinds of things. And we could actually augment his premises. He says things that exist necessarily by necessity of their own nature, it's impossible for them not to exist. And then you have things that are produced by external causes. Something had to produce them. The existence of God lies in the necessity of his own nature. It is impossible for God to have a cause. If God exists, he is necessarily an uncaused being. Follow the logic there? If God exists, then he is necessarily an uncaused being. It's a lot to wrap your mind around in an evening. That's the reason why there's coffee and cookies in the back. Partake liberally, as I will as well. It's been a long day. So, how would you tangle with this? If you're an atheist, how would you attack it? Here's one objection. Would you attack... I'll take it back a slide. Would you attack a different premise? Would you go after another one? Who wants to be brave? There's no... Well, there are wrong answers, but this is a place of safety.
What'd you ask?
Attack one of the premises, if you wish.
The universe exists.
The universe exists. there's not a whole lot of hope for you, my friend, at that point.
Number two, I would say.
Number two?
Yeah.
What would you do with it?
If I was an atheist, I would say his logic is flawed because he's saying that if the universe has an explanation of its existence, that the explanation has to be God.
Okay.
But is he curious how that is addressed in his logics? I'm sure he does.
So I skipped forward a little bit. So that is where some folks go. If the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God. Some folks attack that. The problem is you can't really object to it as an atheist. Atheists really can't object to premise two because their position is the logical equivalent of premise two. Basically, they say if atheism is true, the universe has no explanation of its existence. Yeah, they're saying the exact same thing, right? Because if you could restate what they said, you would say it this way. You understand that? They're the two sides of the same coin, these two statements. So they really can't object to premise two, because that's their argument. They object to premise two, they just shot themselves. So usually they attack premise one. Usually they don't go after premise two, but there are some that do. And we have to very gently point out, you can't attack that one because it's your case. It's yours. So another, if they were to attack premise one, everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, they would sometimes say premise one is true of everything in the universe, but not true of the universe itself. Well, it would be rather arbitrary for an atheist to declare that the universe is the exception to the rule. Everything that exists appear to have a cause, and you must make a case of why it would be an exception, and I believe, fortunately, no such case for why it should be an exception can be made. They can't find any reason. Why do you make an exception? Let's say this. They've come upon this because the universe is so vastly big, right? Let's say you're walking through the woods and you find a crystal spear sitting in the middle of the pathway. Would you not think somebody created that? Right? What if you were driving along the highway and you see a crystal spear the size of this building sitting beside the highway? Wouldn't you think somebody probably created that? Right. So let's get bigger. You find a crystal spear in space. Wouldn't you think, man, somebody manufactured that thing? Size doesn't matter. That's the point. Size doesn't matter. And that's the only thing that they can revert back to when they say that why they're making an exception. It's the size. It's so vast. Well, everything in it was caused. It came into existence. Yes?
Could the universe be one of the things that exists by necessity, though? Or is that, because I don't understand why it couldn't be existing.
We're going to have another argument that's going to address that.
All right.
Yep. That is a potential doorway. And that's the reason why this one may not be a full-fledged argument. We're going to look at interestingly enough, an Islamic scholar who made a very compelling argument as we look at it. We'll see if you think it's compelling as well. So, premise two. So Leibniz's conclusion, if you can't kill the first three premises, the fourth and fifth conclusions have to stand. And for an argument to be a good argument, it just has to be more plausible than not. Right? And what he's going through here, he's saying these premises are more plausible than them not being true. The truth of them is more plausible than them not being true. So the next argument is the Kalam cosmological argument, which I'm going to pronounce weirdly. So basically, there was a debate way back in the day between the Greek philosophers and others about whether or not the universe had a beginning. The Greeks said the universe didn't have a beginning. And they had all kinds of weird ways that the universe was been around and everything else. I won't go into all of them. But Al-Ghazali was a 12th century Muslim theologian from Persian, or modern-day Iran. And he was concerned that Muslim philosophers of his day were being influenced by ancient Greek philosophy to deny God's creation of the universe. And so he embarked on a very, very thorough study, went through all the Greek philosophers, went through his contemporaries, and he wrote a withering critique called The Incoherence of the Philosophers. And it's a fascinating book. He argues that the idea of a beginningless universe is absurd, which is basically what you stated. So we'll get to that. But it's basically a universe that has existed forever. He argues, here are his premises and his conclusions. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. He then states the universe began to exist. In his conclusion, therefore the universe has a cause. Yeah?
So his first premise is kind of like Leibniz's first premise. Is there any difference between an explanation and a cause?
An explanation and a cause? There can be. but it's very similar. You're right. But he takes it in a different direction. Mm-hmm. Right? The argument, I think, is really simple. We should probably memorize this one because it is a good argument. It's easy to memorize, and I think it's really easy to share with folks. It's also a logically airtight argument. If the two premises are true, then the conclusion necessarily follows. So premise one, let's look at that a bit. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Something cannot come from nothing. The claim that something can come into being from nothing is worse than magic. When a magician pulls a rabbit out of the hat, at least you've got the magician, not to mention the hat. But if you deny premise one, you've got to think that the whole universe just appeared at some point in the past for no reason whatsoever. But nobody sincerely believes that things, say a horse or an Eskimo village, can just pop into being without a cause. If something can come into being from nothing, then it becomes inexplicable why just anything or everything doesn't come into being from nothing. Why don't we have things popping into existence all the time? And then common experience and scientific evidence confirm the truth of premise one. It's constantly verified, and it's never been falsified, ever. It's hard to understand how anyone committed to modern science could deny that premise one is more plausibly true than false in light of the evidence. That's what a good argument is. It's more plausibly true than it's plausibly false. And so this one is a pretty solid one. We're going to investigate it a little bit more here in a minute. Premise two, the universe began to exist. And I'll give a philosophical defense of it. An actually infinite number of things cannot exist. And what do I mean by that? And why is that important in conjunction with premise two? The universe began to exist. The other side of the equation says the universe has always existed. It's always been around. And so it extends infinitely back in time. Infinitely back in time. Ghazali says, that's interesting. We've got to discuss that. He argued that if the universe never began to exist, then there have been an infinite number of past events prior to today. But, he argues, an infinite number of things cannot exist. Cannot exist. And this claim needs to be carefully nuanced. Ghazali recognized that a potentially infinite number of things could exist, but he denied that an actually infinite number of things could exist. Does that sound like gobbledygook to you? Raise your hand. It's not. It has to do with this whole thing of infinity. We use infinity in mathematics. We use it to say as so-and-so, as the curve so approaches infinity, you know, those kind of things. It's a concept. But what Ghazali is saying, the whole idea of infinity is only a concept. It doesn't exist in this world that's been created. It doesn't exist there. And so he's saying you can't actually have it. And we're going to give a case in point. A guy came up with an illustration to say an actual infinite set cannot exist. And it's called Hilbert's Hotel. Let's suppose you have a hotel. This hotel goes up forever. There's an infinite number of rooms, and every room is occupied. Grasp that. Now suppose a new guest shows up at the front desk asking for a room. No problem, says the manager. He moves the person who is staying in room number one into room number two. The person who is staying in room number two into room three. The person who is staying in room three into room four. And so on into infinity. As a result of these room changes, room one now becomes vacant. And the new guest gratefully checks in. But before he arrived, all the rooms were already full. You understand it's absurd at that point? It gets absurd, but this is the exact argument that the atheists want us to believe, that everything's existed forever. What if an infinite number of guests arrive? Because infinity's infinity, you can't divide it or anything else, right? So you have an infinite number of guests. The manager would accommodate by having the even number rooms check out and still have an infinite number of rooms available. That's what that means. So that's absurd too. What if all the existing guests and even numbered rooms checked out? Well, since the remaining number of guests are infinite, you cannot divide infinity, you still have an infinite number of guests in the hotel, even though an infinite number of guests have just checked out. It gets even more absurd. This is what happens when you start messing with this whole concept of infinity. It becomes absurd, logically incoherent. Can't do anything with it. And so Hilbert's Hotel is a very interesting exercise, but it illustrates the absurdity of an actual infinite set. The concept can exist in mathematics, but it's just a concept. It doesn't extend into the world that we live in. Conclusion, the universe had a beginning because an actual infinite does not and cannot exist. So I'm going to back this up a little bit. Well, before I do that, can you guys give a scientific defense, I'll ask you guys first, of why the universe came into existence, why we believe the universe came into existence? Anybody?
What do you mean a scientific defense?
Well, we gave a philosophical defense. We just talked about infinity, almost a mathematical defense, if you will. So we, having looked at that area, can we determine through science, or do we have any proofs from science that the universe came into existence at a point in time and does not infinitely extend backwards? The Big Bang Theory. Some would do that. Say that. That. And we'll talk about a little bit of that. I don't know if we need to necessarily embrace everything that comes in the Big Bang package from some of the scientists, but there's definitely some implication and ramifications from what we do know has happened in the universe. That's good. Yep, and that's what I was talking about. We're going to talk about that. The expansion. Does anybody know how we know it's expanding?
Planetary drift
somewhat, but how do we observe it? Because everything's so far apart.
The wavelengths of light.
Oh. Redshift. Oh, we have a genius among us. Okay. Well, I'm going to pop this up and I'm going to explain redshift real fast, if I can. So, you ever notice when you hear a siren, light is waves, okay? Let's understand that first. And so when we're out looking at the universe, we are seeing something called the redshift. We're seeing evidence that planets and universe and galaxies are going further and further away from us. And it seems to be almost uniform throughout space. Everything seems to be moving away from us. And they have called this thing, first observed by Hubble's telescope, the redshift. Now, I got to describe kind of how this all works because it's like redshift. What does that mean? Light is waves. Sound is waves. So if you hear a siren, what does that siren sound like as it's coming towards you? Isn't it higher pitched? What happens after that thing passes you and begins to move away from you again? It gets lower. The siren actually gets lower. And so what's actually happening is this. Here's your little stick man point of reference. Something's coming towards you. Everything's in waves. The waves, what makes them high-pitched is they're really close together, actually like getting compressed in together, and that gives it the high pitch. If this was light, it would be in the blue frequency. Pitch has frequency, light has frequency. It would be blue. As it goes further away from you, those waves start to get bigger and bigger and bigger as it goes further and further away. And then if we equate light to wavelength, that becomes red. And what we're observing in the universe as we look out from Hubble's telescope is that there is a red shift occurring. In other words, the siren is getting lower and lower pitched. Things are moving away from us. And so I should have kept the board up. If something's moving away from us, at some point, what happens? If we reverse back in time, what happens? If everything's moving out, everything condenses, right? And at some point, everything condenses so much it can't go anywhere else. It comes down to one central point. This has led some to speculate as to the Big Bang. This has led others, like myself, saying God created all things and he hung it in space. And there's even Isaiah, I think it's like in the 40th chapter or something, it says that he spreads out the universe, spreads it out like a tent, like a garment. So the idea of spreading it out actually has some biblical merit within the whole entirety of Scripture. And so because everything had to, if you regress everything back in time, it comes down to a central point, you can only go back so far. There has to have been a beginning, in other words. There has to be a point when it started. And if we're following the Kalam cosmological argument, something that begins, what? Has to have a cause. Has to have a cause. Here's another one. The universe began to exist. The third law of thermodynamics. According to the second law of thermodynamics, unless energy is being fed into a system, that system will become increasingly disorderly. So if you take a bottle and you take a little bit of gas and you put it into that bottle, what happens? It's up on the screen too. That gas evenly distributes throughout the bottle. The cohesion between the particles is not enough to hold them all together, and they just spread evenly throughout the bottle. In a little bit of time, it'll happen, and they're all evenly spread. There's nothing holding them together. The chances that the molecules would all huddle together in one corner is practically nil, and this is because there's many more ways in which the molecules could exist in disorder than in an orderly state. You know this because if you have children, because of your children's rooms. The third law of thermodynamics takes over. Things creep towards chaos, disorder, and confusion. The universe, according to the scientists, and I believe this somewhat as well, without God's intervention, will become a featureless soup in which no life is possible. Once the universe reaches such a state, no significant further change is possible. It's at a state of equilibrium in which the temperature and pressure are the same, and they call this the heat death of the universe. Basically, there's no energy anywhere in the universe because it's been so diffused, so dispersed out, there's nothing that you can pull together to do work anymore. Energy is what's transferred into work. So if the universe has existed forever in infinity, then why are we not in a state of heat death right now? Think about that. If the universe has existed forever, no point in time did it come into existence, why hasn't everything run down? Why is it that when we look out into the universe and we look at spiral galaxies, you know, galaxies that are in spirals, I had a picture of one earlier, that as they spin, those arms over long periods of time are actually wrapping themselves down towards the gravitational center of those galaxies. Those arms should all be wrapped up. If we're going towards the heat death of the universe here, there should be nothing but burned out stars. There should be nothing but burned out planets. If everything existed into an infinity in the past, why haven't we reached that state already? Based on the third law of thermodynamics. It's an interesting question. And the only answer to that is, everything came into existence at a point in time. It's the only conclusion that you can draw from that. Anybody think of another conclusion that doesn't involve pink polka-dotted elephants? Okay.
I've heard of one theory. It's kind of like the Big Bang Theory, but it was where the universe is constantly expanding and then contracting, and it is constantly...
And it had to start, even with that argument, though, it had to start in a point in time.
Sure.
Yeah. But the kind of yo-yo thing, over and over and over again. So, the universe has a cause, but what kind of cause is it? Daniel Dennett, who's a noted atheist, and he also agrees that the universe had to have a cause, but he goes on to say this man has a big white beard, looks very grandfatherly. He says that the universe caused itself. That means that the universe would have to exist before it existed, which is nonsense. This Kalam cosmological argument means that the cause of the universe must be transcendent. It must be beyond what's here. The cause must be uncaused, since an infinite number of actual events or things is impossible. It must transcend space, matter, and time, since it created space, matter, and time. Therefore, it must be immaterial and non-physical. It must be unimaginably powerful, since it created all matter and energy. And finally, because you have to have a cause, we didn't get into this argument, but you have to have a cause sufficient for every effect. If we're personal, then this cause must also be personal. And only a mind would fit the description of the first cause. So this doesn't get us to Jesus Christ, right? That's one of the weaknesses. These arguments don't get you there. But it does make a plausible argument for the existence of God. For somebody that's just stone cold saying, you got to show me the evidence, we need to remind them of a few things. We need to remind them of the limitations of the scientific method, as we opened with. The scientific method can only get us so far. It deals with things that we can see, observe, and measure. It has to do with the creation of hypotheses that you can test in a controlled environment over and over and over again. And if that hypothesis is not falsified, eventually it becomes a theory and eventually it becomes a law. Scientific method, that thing, it can't explain everything that's out there. It's somewhat limited. It can't relate to us history. It can't convey to us depth and beauty and all these other things. So there's limitations, and we have to explain those limitations to the atheist. But then we have to also go into these kinds of things, I think. We have to say, you know what? It's plausible that God exists. And not only is it plausible, but I have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, the God of the universe, that sustains me and keeps me and gives me meaning, purpose, and value. Things that you only have as an illusion, and you know you're faking it at the end of the day. Any thoughts? I've done a bit of talking tonight. What do you think of the arguments? Can you think of any other arguments? Arguments that you might use in a witnessing encounter with somebody that doesn't believe in God? Yeah.
So personally, these are deep enough arguments. I'm not even sure what I'm arguing right now. Tonight we argued whether the first beginning or was...
We argued that the existence of God, based on whether or not the universe had a start and those kinds of things.
Whether it was created.
Whether it came into existence. If anything comes into existence, it has to have a cause. And so the arguments are basically just using what's observable and providing plausible, not foolproof, but plausible arguments that God indeed does exist. And this is not salvation. this would get you to kind of the point that, you know, is it Allah? Is it is it the religion of the Buddhists? And is it in Buddhism you have Minayana and Mahayana? You have kind of an atheistic kind of Buddhism where there's more like a power, impersonal power. Then you have Minayana, which is there's a personal being. You get to the idea that there's a God, but who is that God? And we believe as Christians, you have to go to the next step. God has to reveal himself. It's utterly required that God reveals himself, that there's revelation, so that God can tell us about his own character, nature, and person, because he's transcendent. He's beyond anything that we can understand. So he has to come down to our level. And of course, at this point, we talk about the whole comparison between trying to reveal ourselves to an ant. We're beyond an ant's comprehension. And so there, in order to make us known to the ant, we have to do some incredible things. God would have to do infinitely more. So any other questions? Yeah, John.
So much a question, but kind of an observation.
Sure.
When I've had opportunity to share the gospel with soldiers or with students, and they know that I'm quote-unquote religious, oftentimes they'll offer up that they're an atheist.
Yeah.
And if I simply ask the question of, when did you become an atheist? And then I dig deeper of, the question that follows up after that is, when did you stop believing there was a God? Usually it ties to some event, either in their adulthood or their childhood,
yeah,
where something happened where, because of it being a bad, interesting, a bad thing, something that happened that they didn't like or couldn't make sense of, that they said, well, there must be no God. But what's interesting about that is that when you get to the root of it, they realize that there was something that was not right, but they're ultimately blaming God for all that experience they had that was not right, even though they don't believe there was right or wrong.
Yeah.
So
it's based off of a personal, emotional bias rather than evidence. The very thing that they claim is the center of their entire argument. It's interesting.
So I would find that I would get to... then, as I would say, well, I deal with those concerns of just because there is right or wrong, that you're already saying that God says that those things exist, are already proving that you believe something of what God has said in his word. Mm-hmm. But then when they start pulling up the things of science or of, if I could understand this, then I would believe it's all they don't believe something, it's that they believe the alternative, anything that denies God. And it's always tied to that some kind of emotional, traumatic experience.
Yeah.
For themselves or someone they knew that they just could not make sense of.
Yeah.
And so that's their knee-jerk reaction to it, to continue their sin, not really because they believe that there is no God.
Yeah, evolution made satisfied atheists. Before evolution came along and it became fully embodied in its current state, there was atheists, but they were just kind of honest. They would say, I hate God because I see the things that he's done in this world to me and to others, and I can't stand him. He can't be a God of justice. But they didn't have any intellectual satisfaction in that. And they actually, in their atheism, usually acknowledged he existed. But when evolution came along, they now have a vehicle by which they can even deny that existence. It's very interesting. Atheists just simply used to mean not having anything to do with gods. And so even the Christians were known as atheists because they did not take up the Roman pantheon of gods. They would only have to do with Jesus. And that was seen as being blasphemous. And so atheism, the very term atheism has had some change over time. And especially with Darwinian evolution, it's taken on some new nuances. Yeah, Nate.
How do atheists explain emotion and feelings?
Chemical impulses, responses, cause and effect. And a lot of them, when it boils down to it, they're biological determinists. Why did some guy murder somebody? It's the chemicals at the end of the day that causes him to do it. He's driven by his biological urges, and he can't really help it at the end of the day. He's just a victim, more or less, of what's happening to him. Yeah.
I was reading about Albert Einstein with two of my boys today, and it's really weird because he, one of his quotes was that he really couldn't understand a personal God because he couldn't imagine that God would either punish or reward something that he created. But he almost stumbled, I mean, as brilliant as he was, he almost stumbles over himself trying to describe this thing that has caused all of this stuff to happen, but the wonder of it, he almost can't express it because there are no words. When you pull the personal God out of it, he almost is unable, even in the scientific jargon, to make himself understand how it could be. He kind of was, you know, you should be moral because it's good to be moral, because it's helpful to society. Obviously, you know, you're basically telling on your own government to the United States that, you know, the atomic bomb is coming, you might as well get on your own. And it was just really funny because he uses the word God. He just can't...
He can't get away from it.
Yeah, it's like you can't even express these scientific arguments without saying it, but yet he keeps qualifying it out of it. It's really bizarre because...
Oh, it is. It's unlivable. That was our point from earliest on. It's an unlivable worldview. And so there's this constant thing in nature journals or scientific journals where they deify nature. Nature has done this. Nature has, you know, embraced you and all these things. These scientists use these terms because they have to, it can't just be cold and heartless. They have to have some warmth out there in the universe. You know, these guys and women in these labs are thinking the thoughts of God after him. And there is that sense of awe. Even in Richard Dawkins, he talks about the awe of the universe, and he talks about how overwhelming it is, as you mentioned. That was given to them by God, that awe. It's not just a chemical reaction. There's no evolutionary explanation for why you would ever feel awe. It's just not there. You can't come to how it would even be created through evolutionary processes. But they're feeling it, and they don't know how to describe it, and it's the weirdest thing to see them start capitalizing ends for nature and everything else, trying to express this beauty. And they also, because their work is so engaging and so all-encompassing, they see purpose in that work. But to what end? If everything's just coughed them into existence by accident and then is going to swallow them up again without any remembrance, why? You know, they live in an illusion, and they have to create these illusions in order just to survive, just not to be horrendously depressed and end it all with a bullet. That's basically where it is. And the atheist I know Most of them are a very arrogant lot, I'll be honest, and they think the same of us. So we can say it in love towards one another, I guess. But at the end of the day, they're also a very desperate lot. There's a great sadness that suffuses them. There's a thoughtfulness. And according to Scripture, they're actually suppressing the truth. There's an active will engaged there, even though they say God does not exist. Richard Dawkins can say, I've never even had a flutter of a religious feeling. He's actively suppressing the truth. And our job is to rip it wide open and say, God has all glory in this world, and this world agrees with God's word. And there are plausible arguments, and I can show you the arguments like these that make it plausible, and then I can take you to the revelation of Jesus Christ that shows that God has meaning, God has value, and God has purpose, even here. It's the reason why we live as hopefully transformed beings, people that have real mission within life. And hopefully you're befriending atheists as you can find them. I'm still looking for one. I reached out to them. They haven't responded. The first set hasn't responded. I'm going to try another atheist organization, see if we can get one in here. And we can talk to them a bit. Anything else tonight? Y'all have been very patient. It's about 7:30. Next week, we're going to be looking at teleology, the argument from design. We're going to talk about an anthropocentric universe that's finely tuned for life, particularly on this planet, and talk about some of those evidences that maybe you're more familiar with rather than the Clam cosmological argument or Leibniz's premises and those kinds of things. But I think that those arguments, Leibniz and Clam from Al-Ghazali, I think those are really telling, and I think they're worthy of memorizing and kind of thinking through, because they give glory to God at the end of the day. So looking forward to teleology. Let's go ahead and close with prayer, and we'll be dismissed. Dear Heavenly Father, I thank you for this evening. I thank you for folks at the end of a long, weary day who were attentive, that were thoughtful, that were polite, that asked good questions. Dear Father, I pray that you would bless them with your thoughts. Dear Father, with your Holy Spirit empowerment, that they would have just divine boldness to speak into situations, into the lives of atheists, into the lives of people that worship different gods, that they'd do it with loving graciousness. And dear Father, that you would give them clear answers. I pray also, dear Father, that you would bless their time in this class, that you would bring to their remembrance in those moments the things that we've discussed. And dear Father, that your glory and renown would be greater because of their voices. It's in the name of Jesus Christ we pray. Amen.